You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews. First, an interview with author Eula Biss, whose book On Immunity and Inoculation is now out in paperback from Grey Wolf Press. After this interview, you'll hear a conversation that Gary Lee Miller conducted with the author Cecilia Tichy, whose book Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America, came out in September from University of North Carolina Press. We'll be running long today, so if you run out of time, you can check out both of these interviews on the podcast site. Eula Biss is the author of three books, On Immunity and Inoculation, The Balloonists, and Notes from No Man's Land, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism, and which Salon deemed the most accomplished book of essays anyone has written or published so far in the 21st century. Eula Biss holds a BA in nonfiction writing from Hampshire College and an MFA in nonfiction writing from the University of Iowa. Her work has appeared in The Believer, Harper's Magazine, The Best American Non-Required Reading, The Touchstone Anthology of Contemporary Nonfiction, Gulf Coast, Denver Quarterly, Third Coast, and The New York Times. She has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Howard Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and she is a winner of a Jaffe Writers Award. She lives in the Chicago area and teaches at Northwestern University. Eula Biss and John Bresland are the Chicago-based band Stet Everything. Her latest book, On Immunity and Inoculation, was a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist and was named one of the best books of 2014 by the New York Times Book Review, Entertainment Weekly, New York Magazine, Chicago Tribune, Publishers Weekly, Time Out New York, Los Angeles Times, Kirkus, Booklist, NPR's Science Friday, Newsday, Slate, Refinery 29, and more. In this bold, fascinating book, Eula Biss addresses our fear of the government, the medical establishment, and what may be in our children's air, food, mattresses, medicines, and vaccines. Reflecting on her own experience as a new mother, she suggests that we cannot immunize our children or ourselves against the world. As she explores the metaphors surrounding immunity, Biss extends her conversations with other mothers to meditations on the myth of Achilles, Voltaire's Candide, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, Susan Sontag's AIDS and its metaphors, and beyond. On Immunity is an inoculation against our fear and a moving account of how we are all interconnected, our bodies and our fates. On Immunity and Inoculation has just come out in paperback. The book begins and ends by discussing, among other things, myths and tales. It begins with the myth of Achilles, whose mother tried to make him immortal by dipping him in the river Styx. In closing, the author discusses the myth of Narcissus, who fell in love with his own reflection in water and ultimately drowned, not understanding that it was an image. When I spoke with Eula Biss, I asked her to talk about this creative decision to begin and end her book by drawing on myth.
There were a few different reasons for that, for beginning and ending in myth. Sometimes when I say there's a few different reasons, I think back on, I think, an interview with Marilynne Robinson that I saw once. Or it may have been something, I was long ago, I was her student, so she might have actually said it in class. But somewhere she mentioned that she never makes anything happen in any one of her novels. So a character never says anything or does anything for less than seven reasons. And so that's what I've been trying to live up to. I don't think I've yet gotten to the seven reasons level as a writer. I'm happy with three or four.
That's hilarious.
And when I'm teaching, I really just want my students to have one. But in this case, I did have several reasons. So one of the reasons, which might even be, sometimes I don't know whether these reasons appear in retrospect or whether they're the reasons that drive the decision, but one of the reasons was that I wanted to foreground the fact that these questions that the book is tackling are old questions. And they haven't just appeared with this technology, which is itself actually, in terms of modern medicine, pretty old.
Right.
So, it, you know, vaccination is much older than x-rays or penicillin or the practice of sterilizing instruments or wounds. So in that sense, even the technology is old, but I was thinking old on a whole different scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about how this impulse to protect a child against things that the child might not be, that you might not be able to protect the child against, this kind of hopeless impulse towards protection,
right,
is an old impulse, and there's stories about it. There's people have been working through and thinking about this impulse for a long time. So that's part of why I liked the idea of starting with Achilles in particular, but myth in general.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was also interested in playing on, the word myth was in my mind as I was working on vaccination, because it comes up a lot in this subject area. People talk about the myths that are believed around vaccination.
Yeah.
And that term is usually used disparagingly, like, oh, people who resist vaccination believe all these myths. And I kind of wanted to resurrect the other meaning of that term, and that myths aren't just things that are untrue. They are that, but they're also, you know, stories that get at emotional truths and get at real psychological problems. So even though there are things that many of us believe about vaccination that are technically untrue, some truth about our own fears or concerns might be revealed there in those concerns that are possibly factually inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other, you know, the other reason was very much more workaday, much more technical. I wrote the beginning of the book fairly late in the process. I'd written much of the book by the time I started working out those first few pages. And I asked myself the question that appears in the first sentence. I asked myself, what's the first thing I ever learned about immunity?
Mm-hmm.
And so that appears in the first sentence. The first thing I ever learned about immunity was the myth of Achilles. As it turned out, I was kind of remembering that wrong, and I correct myself a few, you know, pages later.
Right.
And that it was another myth that I was remembering.
Right,
because this was, you know, I was reaching back in my memory back till probably like 6 or 7 years old. So, and then ending on Narcissus, you know, part of this is my aesthetics as a writer. I do love a certain symmetry in a text. But I also liked, I liked these two myths as bookends.
Yeah.
I liked the way that they, to me, they both read as cautionary tales,
mm-hmm.
but the caution is different.
It's very
in
different.
Each one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Oh, no, you know, sort of at the risk of overstating it, I felt when I started the book that the myth of Achilles offered a benefit of the doubt for mothers who will try to do anything to protect their children out of love. Whereas I felt at the end that the myth of Narcissus is certainly a myth that's more about arrogance, too. And
mm-hmm.
I found that really interesting, you know, and not at all overstated, except now I've overstated it.
No. And yeah, that's exactly, you know, that's the delicate line that I think the whole book is riding.
Yes.
Is being compassionate and towards the impulse to protect a child, even when that impulse is kind of wayward or wrongheaded in some way or another. And I say that as someone who has followed that impulse myself as
yeah.
a mother.
Right.
And so being compassionate towards that, but also, you know, and this is turning more towards Narcissus, critiquing that impulse too.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so holding both in the same space, a sense of I understand this and I feel for this impulse, but it leads us to do things that could be destructive to other people.
Right.
One aspect of the book that I really enjoyed was how it's very personal. In addition to having lots of different cultural implications, political implications, historical references, and science, you know, it's also personal. And you talk in the book about your son and your own personal experience as a mother, and also as a daughter. You're often mentioning and quoting your father, who's a physician, And after a while, I started to notice that the stories of your son sort of influenced an emotional response in you, where the stories of your father led you back to science. And that was such a fun balance to keep seeing in your own stories that you shared.
Yeah, that is interesting. I've never thought of those two. I guess I've never put those two things into categories, so I've never thought about whether I dealt with them differently. You know, to begin with, the initial draft of this was probably the least personal work that I've ever written. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not entirely sure all the reasons for that. But one was, I was really captivated by the ideas in this particular book and the conceptual problems. And my initial draft had very little of my son in it, which is kind of surprising because, you know, more than this is a book about vaccination, it's a book about parenting in my mind. Mm-hmm. So to write a book about parenting and barely mention your child, I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's another impulse toward protection, right?
It is, and I think that's a good part of where that came from. You know, part of it was I was captivated by the ideas, but I also think I was quite reluctant to bring my son to the page. And for, I think, fairly good reason. You know,
sure.
He has, you know, he's gotten probably a little more exposure through this book than I would want for him.
Right.
But that's the fallout of his mother being the kind of artist that I am.
Well, luckily he's very little in the book. You know, it's not like you're exposing his teenage secrets or anything.
Right. We'll have to hash out all these problems again in 10 years. but yeah, the personal material began to creep in actually when there were things that I found were less effective if I was just in that kind of meditative mode, just thinking on the page.
Mm-hmm.
There were certain things I wanted to tackle that were very, very difficult for me to tackle in that mode. And the one that comes to mind first is the section where my son gets surgery. And that was something I very much did not want to write about. And I was very hesitant to do that. And I wrote it and then took it out. Because of my sense of feeling exposed, both exposing myself and exposing my son, which is something I almost never feel as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I think people assume that the personal material makes a writer feel that way, and it almost never makes me feel that way. But it did in that on that occasion.
Right.
Maybe because my thinking through that episode didn't feel finished. It didn't feel complete, and I didn't feel entirely secure in it. But I think that's also why I had to write about it. That moment in the text had been just a meditation on paternalism in medicine. And in just talking and thinking on the page about paternalism, I couldn't quite seem to capture the quandary that I felt was there, the real stakes of the matter. Like, we depend on this.
Right.
And at the same time, it's conducted in a way that is deeply sometimes violent to us. And so we should say
that was a moment of real conflict within the actual hospital. There was a difference of opinion between yourself and the anesthesiologist about how to proceed, and it was a very difficult moment for you as a mother.
Yeah, exactly. The conflict was I was asking to be present while my son was put under anesthesia and when he came back to consciousness, which is actually standard practice in some hospitals. In this one, it was not. But I was a little surprised because I had talked to a nurse who worked at another hospital where this was done. So I knew that some places did it this way.
Right.
And so there was a conflict between me and the anesthesiologist that grew because of the way that he talked to me.
Yes.
And his assumption that I was a hysterical, uncontrolled, over-emotional woman who was dangerous to my child because
right.
of those qualities.
Right, and he also got very sarcastic and inappropriate, apart from protecting mm-hmm. your child in his own way.
Yeah, there was some bad bedside manner, for sure, in there,
right.
mixed in with some things that I think are very typical of paternalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me, it was a rich terrain to explore these questions of paternalism. I got very worked up and very upset about this episode. In the end, the surgery that was facilitated by this anesthesiologist was a really great benefit for my son's health. Mm-hmm. It was quite incredible, much more than we expected it to be. So that's the quandary that I was trying to wade around in, is look at this great benefit, but look at what it costs.
Right. Right.
And so I couldn't find a way to do that that didn't call on that personal material. It seemed to me that actually was the best and, in the end, the only vehicle for that conversation.
Right. You know, from that same section, is it all right with you if I read a quote from the book?
Sure, yeah.
So you write, in the 20th century, psychologists blamed schizophrenia on overbearing mothers who smothered their children. Homosexuality, categorized as a mental illness until 1973, was blamed on anxious mothers who coddled their children. Autism, according to the prevailing theory of the 1950s, was blamed on cold, insensitive refrigerator mothers. Even now, mothers provide, quote, a convenient missing link in germ theory, as the psychotherapist Yana Malamud-Smith observes. If it is not viral or bacterial, she quips, it must be maternal. That and other aspects of this particular essay were fascinating and infuriating to me, including I didn't realize that the treatment of bleeding patients really sort of resulted from a competitiveness between men and women, women having been very successful and making contributions in medicine, and male doctors deciding that everything they did was wrong and they needed to do other things. And I wonder if you can talk about the even now in that even now mothers provide a convenient missing link in germ theory. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, this impulse to lay blame for illness in a way that is tinged with sexism, racism, classism,
mm-hmm.
all our prejudices, this impulse hasn't left us. You know, it's very evident in history. It's very easy to see. But part of what writing this book did for me is the more I looked at that historically, the more aware I became of how present it is in our contemporary landscape.
Yeah.
And I began to notice it in my own medical care, too. I saw it creeping in. For instance, I had a very, very rare complication of childbirth that happened after a very healthy, normal pregnancy. So nobody saw this coming, including me, including my midwife. I would have been and was encouraged to have birth at home if I wanted to.
Mm.
And I had this very rare complication, and the complication scared everyone, me, my midwife,
mm-hmm.
everyone who was present, because it was life-threatening and it was fairly dramatic. And I think while she was still under the kind of influence of that drama, my midwife said to me, you know, after I'd survived the complication and the surgery that followed, she said something about how my placenta that had been delivered looked unusual. And then she insinuated that maybe I had done something during my pregnancy
wow.
to cause this problem. You know,
yeah.
maybe I'd eaten the wrong thing, or maybe I'd made a bad decision, was her insinuation. you know, and this, it was an urge to blame that came out of really just a scared lack of understanding. And it wasn't her specific lack of understanding. This was just a situation where something happened for no reason. Right. And that's really hard to accept. And, you know, and that's part of where I think this refrigerator mother thing came from. You know, we still don't know exactly what's causing autism. And when we flail about and try to lay blame, we follow our prejudices. And mm-hmm. and often, you know, the mother is the most available, first and easiest target for blame. And I actually saw this in reviews of my book, you know, some of them positive, but some of the negative reviews were very quick to blame me for my son's allergies, for instance. Hmm. And that's something that I struggle with in the book. You know, I already blamed myself, but then, you know, it's particularly painful to see, again, someone else doing that to me in a review. But, you know, these are personal examples, but I think this is, I also see it all the time. I see it in the people I know who are stricken by illness. I see the people around them getting scared and then trying to find some reason why that person should be blamed for their own illness.
Right.
Well, you know, they did this or that wrong. You know, of course, it's a new version of the old idea that God is punishing you, that mm-hmm. and God is punishing you for a sin. And he's punishing you through this illness that you've been stricken with.
Right, and doesn't it also sort of come from the speaker, I'll say, the speaker's need to say, God wouldn't punish me that way. There's a reason that this
right.
is happening to you,
yeah,
and it's nothing that will happen to me.
Yes, exactly, because
right.
I am good,
right.
and I am pure. So really, this blaming comes from a real need to feel safe. You know, and a need to feel secure and like this won't happen. But it's interesting to see it. I think that lay people are guilty of it. Physicians are guilty of it. It's, you know, it's not just a medical establishment thing. It's a cultural thing.
Right.
And it's an old, deeply embedded cultural thing.
Yeah.
And Susan Sontag has written beautifully about it around both cancer and HIV. And the other place that I you know, saw evidence of this that was so interesting to me is in Defoe's novel, A Journal of the Plague Year, which is set in the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
So much different landscape. You know, germ theory is you know, only just emerging, but this is a time when nobody believes it. There's even a moment when Defoe, his narrator, engages with germ theory and then writes it off as preposterous because it sounded crazy. That there's little tiny dragons in your breath that make you sick.
right.
But, you know, in that time, people were dying of the plague left and right, and nobody knew why, and nobody knew. There was a sense that it was passed from person to person, but nobody quite understood how. And, you know, there was, at that time, it was very common to just call it the work of God and assume that this person had sinned. But Defoe's narrator resists that. He says, I don't really think that that's everything that's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's important, you know, for us to continually question the theories of disease that we come up against because they can be colored by our cultural prejudices.
Right. I wanted to just mention one story in the book that is so fascinating, and I think I knew of it before, but I was really pleased to read this again, the history of cowpox and the milkmaid's relative health leading to early inoculation practices. You know, there were all these people getting sick with, I guess, smallpox, and these milkmaids were healthy. People would sort of decide that they were evil because, of course, that's what we do. but then eventually the farmers were actually inoculating their families. You want to just talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I thought this was fascinating. I didn't know any of this. And so this is in the 100 years or so before Jenner pioneers vaccination. But what Jenner does is something that has already been happening for quite a long time. And that is milkmaids and farmers acquiring cowpox from mm-hmm. milking cows. So they'll get blisters on their hands, and those blisters are an infection that they've caught from the cow. But that infectious agent is so closely related to smallpox that it actually serves as a proxy for that pathogen. So the person's body mounts an immune response, and it makes them immune to smallpox. Mm-hmm. What was remarkable about this is that, you know, milkmaids were famous for being lovely, right? And this is preserved in, like, nursery rhymes and songs and fairy tales. And I'd never thought about why there was this reputation. And part of it was because everyone in that time period got smallpox. And it was very common for your face to be scarred and sometimes disfigured by smallpox. So people lost lips, people lost parts of their noses, people lost eyelids, people lost ears to smallpox. And so not getting smallpox was a great boon to your beauty. and this is part of where this idea of the fresh-faced milkmaid comes from.
Right.
She hasn't had smallpox. Well before Jenner, people were noticing this, and they didn't understand what was going on. They didn't understand the mechanism. Neither did Jenner, though. And at some point, 20 years before Jenner, a farmer intentionally injected smallpox or cowpox into his wife and sons. And he did this because there was a smallpox epidemic. And so what he was doing was inoculating, vaccinating his wife and sons.
Right, right.
And it worked, though, you know, he was doing a very, very kind of primitive version of what we do now. You know, he used a darning needle, and he took the material directly out of the cow's udder, and it was probably contaminated with all sorts of other bacteria. So
we don't really want to think about that.
Exactly. to me, this was really interesting, and it was fascinating to see that this was folk medicine. This wasn't a kind of cutting-edge development of modern medicine. This was a folk practice, and it was actually much older than that. You know, it had found its way to England by the 1700s, but people had been inoculating their children, especially in the East, in China and India, for hundreds of years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I was unaware of before I started doing this research that kind of blew my mind.
Yeah.
That this is not only folk medicine, but ancient folk medicine.
I wanted to ask you, we've all met people who do not believe in vaccinating their children. This line from the book really struck me. It was influenced by the observations of the author Paul Slovic. Mm-hmm. And the line is, when we encounter information that contradicts our beliefs, we tend to doubt the information and not ourselves. So I wondered if we could talk about that. And then also, I'm curious how vocal you are at this point in the presence of parents who choose not to vaccinate or who will talk about their, you know, not wanting to and perhaps in a paranoid way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that research on risk perception was some of the most interesting research to me,
mm-hmm.
And it really forced me to think about my own risk perception. And, you know, part of what Slovic finds is that people are remarkably terrible at assessing risk.
Yeah.
Everyday people are pretty bad at telling the difference between something that it poses them great risk and something that poses them very minimal risk. And that was really, really interesting to me. And it made me think about how I go about my everyday risk assessment, which made me realize that, I take major risks every day with both my own safety and my child's safety. We ride our bikes almost every day, and during the time I was writing this book, I carried him on the back of my bicycle. The risk of injury on a bicycle is just so much greater than the risk of injury from vaccination that it's almost not even worth comparing the two.
Right.
But I hardly ever thought about the risk of putting him on my bicycle. I was aware, you know, I was careful, but it never occurred to me that I would not bike with him because of the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that sent me into long and sometimes complicated meditations about what risks do we accept and why, and where do we refuse information and where do we not. And this book was really born out of and built on conversations with other parents, most of them women, who didn't think the same way I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's what makes conversation interesting.
Right.
I have really little desire to spend all my time talking to people who think the same way I think. And my mind was changed many times over in the course of these conversations. And I think it's worth pointing out that my mind changed over the course of writing this book. I refused the first vaccination on the standard schedule. So in some ways you could say that I started out anti-vaccination, though I don't think that was I wouldn't have called myself that.
Mm-hmm.
And many people who take that action probably wouldn't call themselves that. I started out there and ended up somewhere very different. And part of that was owed to conversations with other parents, and part of it was owed to research. Part of it was owed to conversations with researchers. But I still really value those conversations, which is not to say that they aren't exhausting, you know. And
yeah.
Recently I ended up on a two-hour flight next to a woman who asked me what I did, and I always kind of brace myself when people ask me that question, because then I know, well, I've written a book about race and I've written a book about vaccination, so it's going to be one uncomfortable conversation or another.
Do you ever just say, I'm a mom?
Right. But, you know, and we got into a pretty heated two-hour conversation while she was nursing her baby right next to me. Mm-hmm. On the plane, which, you know, the stakes are much higher when you've got the baby right there in the flesh and blood, and
right.
And you're both aware of the consequences of what you're talking about. But in the end, you know, we closed that conversation on very good terms, and we were really happy to have talked to each other.
Yeah.
And I walked away from that feeling like, oh, look at all these interesting places this book is landing me. All these interesting conversations.
Yeah.
With someone who otherwise I might have just, you know, discussed with her, you know, the model of pacifier that she happened to be using or something like that. You know, instead we got into a really pretty deep and interesting conversation about moral and ethical questions in the end.
Yeah, yeah. The book is fascinating. It's been exceptionally well reviewed. It's been a bestseller, a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, chosen best book of 2014 by more publications than I have time to mention. So I just want to thank you so much for talking with me. I'll just say again, the book is On Immunity, an Inoculation by Eulabis, published by Grey Wolf Press. The book is now out in paperback. Eula, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Eula Biss. You can learn more about her work at her website, eulabiss.net, and that is spelled EulaBiss, eulabiss.net. I have a new Write the Book prompt for you, which is an exercise suggested by my guest, Eula Biss. She learned it a long time ago at an AWP panel, and she doesn't recall whose idea it was, and so she was clear on asking that I not credit her for it, because she cannot credit the person who gave it to her. But she does use it as both a writer and a teacher, so she's sharing it. Write a scene or a moment from a bright spot in your memory. It isn't necessary to understand why you're writing about it. You don't have to know why it's important or why you remember it. But write from this bright spot, this moment that rises quickly and easily to the surface. And then read over what you've written, a paragraph or a page, whatever you've written. And then, without reading it again or looking it over, write again using a different tense. Eula has noticed that different verb tenses will draw out different material. Often she will compose in the present tense because it draws out richer detail. And then, if it makes the most sense, she will switch it to another tense like the past later. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Actually, there's going to be another one on the podcast site after Gary's interview. Write the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. Also by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host, Gary Miller, has a website, GaryLeeMiller.com, and you're actually about to hear from him, as he has a new interview with the author Cecilia Tichy coming right up. If you have a guest to suggest for Write the Book, or news about book-related events, or comments about the show, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.